a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Greetings to our internet listeners. We've been trying to connect with a couple of senators via telephone. We have been unsuccessful in doing that, so if we get interrupted with their arrival on via telephone, I will be expecting that to happen. Welcome to everybody this morning. Reminder to silence your cell phones, please. And with that, we'll have the ask the secretary to call the roll.
Senator Bartley, Senator Gillespie, Senator Hunhoff,
here.
Senator Haverly,
here.
Senator Teason,
here.
Representative Byrd, Representative Dennard,
here.
Representative Jockey,
here.
Representative Peters,
here.
Representative Turbeville,
here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. First order of business is to approve the minutes from the October 4th meeting.
Second.
Motion by Representative Turbeville, second by Representative Peters. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Second order of business today. We're going to receive reports from a number of departments and bureaus regarding funds. These funds were selected by this committee for, I guess, a variety of reasons. One would be for the educational value that this committee can get from better understanding of these funds. In some cases, some of these funds have seen significant changes in their balance, or in some other way have been of interest to this committee or to the legislature. So we appreciate the various departments' willingness to come before the committee to provide those explanations and perhaps to answer any questions we might have. First on the list is the Department of Labor to review the Employment Security Contingency Fund. That would be Company 3030. Welcome, gentlemen. If you'll introduce yourselves and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick Flemmer. I'm the administrative service.
Go ahead, Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much did you transfer into the UI administration fund again? And how many times have you done that transfer?
Transferred in $454,000. Employment Security Administrative account for UI activities. We've done the transfer probably almost every year for the last 5 years.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have $454,000 from the from this particular contingency fund into the UI administration fund. You've done it, the transfer you do on an annual basis for the last 5 years. What is the average transfer that you've made into the UI administration fund?
About $250,000. This last year was quite a bit higher.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow
Continue, yes.
How is it figured? How is that transfer figured? How is that number figured out?
Just what's in the account.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow
Go ahead.
My understanding was anything over in the contingency fund, anything over that $15,000 reverted to the UI trust fund. So what you're telling me is first you take out X percent out of this contingency fund to go into the UI administration fund, then you take how much actually hits our UI trust fund?
Last year, $623,000 went into the trust fund.
Any other questions from the committee at this point?
Just
as a follow-up then, so I understand this, the significant changes that have taken place in this account in recent years is, number one, the income has increased significantly because of the new statute that charges interest on the negative accounts. And secondly, in recent years there has been greater transfers to the administrative fund before the balance goes to the trust fund.
Right, as you know, most people are aware, unemployment has risen the last in our federal administrative UI budget.
It was back in 09. We had an emergency clause on it.
Okay. Sure. I understand Senator Bartling is in the process of joining us by phone. Senator Bartling, are you there?
Yes, good morning, I am. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome. We're in the middle of a presentation from Department of Labor.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll
Welcome.
Pull that document up. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead with your presentation. There.
There. The only other thing I'd like to point out is that
okay, if you would, if it goes where, you would have to say that again, please, if you would.
The monies were not used for
okay. Representative Dennert.
I was just curious, you said last year this money was
Representative Dennert, can you hold on a second? Are we having trouble with
that one's not showing up either. The mic's not.
Is this one working?
No.
Only you and me have mics.
Well, I apologize to our internet listeners. Obviously, part of our microphone systems not work, and we'll go ahead. Representative Dennert, sorry, I apologize for the interruption.
I'll try to raise my voice a little bit. You said last year, and yet your fiscal year 20, $885,000. What dates are you talking? We had a jump to $600,000 in the ending balance, and I'm trying to get a handle on when you say last year this money was transferred to the two funds. I guess that would be my question.
Go ahead.
We operate the fund on a federal fiscal year, October 1 to September 30th, because the statute requires us to clean it out on a September 30th basis.
Okay. Thank you. You indicated something about September earlier in your testimony, but I just see the increase here.
Any other questions from the committee? Vice Chair is looking for the statute that changed the rules on that. Do either one of you happen to have that in front of you?
I do not.
Okay. Any other comments from the committee? Representative Dennert.
It's kind of amusing to me, I guess I'm going to use the word amusing, that we go along with the income fines and forfeits of $250,000 to $300,000. And all of a sudden we have a statute that we charge penalties and pick up $600,000. How do these people that are paying this penalty account for that kind of dollar? I mean, that's a fine, isn't it? The money's got to come from someplace. I'm confused how you can have that many more dollars come in penalties and interest from these companies. Evidently, if the principal amount is only this, how can you get that many dollars of penalties?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to get.
2009, we added the additional penalty where we charge interest to those employers who have a negative balance in their UI account. The reason that they initiated this is because our UI trust fund, if you see, funds interest. So if some employer has a negative balance, we're losing money on that negative balance because we're not earning any interest on it. So the statute was changed that we charge the employer that interest now. makes up for the monies we're not earning in interest from the feds. We collect that now, and then we deposit it back in the trust fund.
And still, but if you'd be earning the interest from the feds, where would that interest income show up in your income statement?
It would just be part of the trust fund earnings. Okay.
Question that I would have would be, have we seen a reduction in those penalties once this new statute has come online? Are those folks catching on, and do we plan to see that reduced over time, you think?
We haven't seen it yet because it's relatively new. It just started in March of 2009, so it's just over a year old. Yeah, I suspect so. A lot of employers kind of always pay their taxes late. They kind of always run a negative balance. I think none of these penalties have increased. I'm sure they'll keep it looking in their accounts in positive.
I think so.
So actually, you know, these penalties interest will probably go down because of these changes.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Did you find the statute?
We did. We're working. We just found the bill.
Okay. All right. In the absence of any other questions, thank you for the presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think that was the one to take the stage one of those federal unemployment insurance dollars.
First of all, do we have any update on our technology issue here? Waiting on it? Okay. Next up is Public Utilities Commission in a very timely appearance. We'll welcome you to the front right away and move on.
Trying to think.
The committee will come back to order. I think we have our technology working all the way around the room now. Next item is Public Utilities Commission to review the Gross Receipts Tax Fund Company 3128. Good morning, Commissioner. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Steve Kolbeck. I'm the current chairman of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. Thank you for the opportunity for us to join you here this morning and discuss the South Dakota gross receipts tax. With me, I have Cindy Chemnitz. She's our finance manager. I also have Patty Van Gerpen. She's our executive director, our assistant executive director, Leah Moore, and everyone knows Commissioner Gary Hansen is with me also. He's kind of like a beetle. Everybody knows him. So what we have put together this morning is a little bit of information. Hopefully it's what you're looking for and what you're interested in our time allowed. We do not have a PowerPoint presentation. However, we do have the two handouts that we've already distributed to you. What I would like to do first is go over the handout titled Gross Receipts Tax. It is somewhat of a frequently asked questions handout, and I'd like just to start and give you a brief overview of that document. The fund, the South Dakota PUC Gross Receipts Tax Fund, was created in 1975 by the legislature with Senate Bill 216. The original name was the Special Hearing Fund, not hearing as in deaf and hard of hearing, but actually more in a judicial sense. The original rate assessed was 0.001%, paid for by consumers only in the state of South Dakota. The funds are currently for the PUC to use for expenses of dockets that are not allowed to be charged back to any specific company. The purpose of these funds changed during the 1991 legislature with Senate Bill 238. It was then that the fund expanded to permit full and adequate regulation of public utilities as defined in SDCL 4934A and telecommunications companies defined in SDCL 4931-128. For one thing, the name was changed in 1991 to the South Dakota PUC Gross Receipts Tax Fund, and it also became able to earn interest. Second, late payments were added, and a 10% fee of tax owed per month was assessed. Third, the maximum tax levy was raised to what it is now, some 20 years later, to .0015, or $250, whichever is greater, upon the annual intrastate gross receipts of those companies. To set up the next change, a little bit more history. In 2001, the legislature transferred out of the GRT $500,000 for heating assistance. So in 2003, the legislature added language that these funds may not be expended for any other operations of state government. Also in 2003, the legislature added a cap on or a contingency to include some internal prudence that the reserve may not exceed the prior year's budget. The second handout there is more of a numbers-based handout. It's an updated history of the South Dakota, a balanced history of the South Dakota PUC gross receipts tax. It shows you how the fund grows and shrinks without any consistent variable. It was my understanding that you only had information of the fund balance up until 2010. What all of this does is brings us to where we are today. I hope we've given you a little bit of direction and understanding about our gross receipts tax. And I understand you may have some questions of myself or Commissioner Hansen, so we'll just stand by ready to take those.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Not yet. Can we run?
Representative Peters.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm still working kind of on the Department of Labor one that we just finished a few minutes ago. But the first question that jumps out at me is we have seen a relatively substantial growth over the past few years in this particular fund. Why have we seen a general increase? Do we need to reduce the fines, or are the fines that are going into this fund, are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? Is there I guess we'll just start with that one.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Cindy Chemnitz, the finance manager. When you say fines, we have very few fines that are going into this fund. It's more the gross receipts tax. With the handout that we gave you, the utilities, and it's based on that utilities revenues that were reported. And as you can see, that they did increase from fiscal year 2008 to 2010. I guess the point that we're showing here is in 2011, they decreased greatly also. So it's not necessarily fines that are going into that. We have some small fines that go into that, but the majority of it is the gross receipts tax. We do have chargeback dockets that when and the analysts or any of us work on those dockets, in particular like a rate case, we can charge up to a certain amount of money back to those instead of using our gross receipts funds to fund our salaries and stuff. We're on a time study. So that has a little bit to do with our balance too, how much we actually spend in those in that account. So if we have a lot of chargeback dockets, we can charge our time to those companies appropriately, and then we don't have to spend our gross receipts tax for those expenditures. And we do have a cap on what we can have in that account, and we really haven't come close to exceeding that cap in the last few years.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Peters.
Thank you. So we've got three main income sources or revenue sources in this particular fund. I just want to make sure I clarify this. Line 14 in our little sheet, and I'm assuming that you see what I see on this sheet on line 14. It says taxes. Mm-hmm. The taxes for fiscal year 2010 says 1.8. And then licenses, permits, and fees, and then uses of money and property. So the gross receipts tax is the 1.8. The licenses, the permits, and the fees, is that the fines? And then what's and then the uses of money and property, is that the chargeback line item?
No. The top one is the gross receipts tax. And the fines, I'm assuming, would maybe be put into that. We have very few fines. Again, we don't charge many for fines. That's if somebody's paid late. The license, permits, and fees is for when, like a telecommunications company wants to request a certificate of authority, there's a $250 fee that they pay for that service for us to look over their documents before we would grant or approve that certificate of authority. The use of money or property is where our interest proration comes from the state.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So where would I find the breakout for your chargeback for rate cases?
That is not in the gross receipts tax at all because that is paid through company 8316.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I follow up. So we were talking before about this particular fund, but you said chargebacks. So the chargebacks are not in this particular fund.
No, they offset basically this fund because we can charge to that fund instead of this fund.
Okay.
So just to make sure I've got this right then, so those chargebacks to that other fund really is, that's this kind of the controlling factor to this fund being up or down is your ability to charge back to the other fund. This fund gets charged if you can't charge back to the other fund.
Correct. That and revenues from the utility companies if they fluctuate a lot. A natural gas is one example that's fluctuated this past year when natural gas prices are down. Then the revenues are down, therefore they don't pay as much gross receipts tax.
Okay. Other questions from Commissioner?
I was just going to say one other example of that is the Black Hills Power docket that we just had. They had gone over their maximum allowed that we could charge to them by $162,000. So we had to take that out of the gross receipts tax.
Okay. I was going to ask that specific example, but you already covered it, so thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. I just need a clarification here, just to understand the process, if you would. You've talked about company 8316, and then we're in this company right here. Again, you're using the taxes that come in from what for company 8316?
Well, for instance, like Black Hills Power, when we had a rate case with them, anything on our time study that they charged to a certain time code, then we charge Black Hills Power up into that max. that maximum amount.
Follow up. How's that maximum amount established?
That's in statute, and it's $100,000 without an IRP and $125,000 with an IRP.
Follow up, please. What's an IRP, please? There has to be a simple terminology that you can
use. It's a resource planning. In other words, their demand response and how the company anticipates how they're going to institute their individual resource planning, how they're going to manage their generation.
Okay,
go ahead.
Just one last. All right. So if then from these from the licenses and permits for these companies that you're working with, how many of them are they exceeding that you have to come into this other fund to pay the difference? What are we talking about there?
In the rate cases, we have one right now that's just started, so we don't know where that's going to end up. Black Hills Power was over and above the maximum. And then we had two before that, one in 2008 and one in 2009, that came very close to being over the max. I think that this is probably a trend for the future as we go forward, that we could start seeing more. It kind of depends on, you know, how many interveners we have, how big the rate case is, things like that that cause us to go over our maximum.
One last question. What's your charge then to go back? Is it an hourly rate, or what is it when you say you charge, like Black Hills Power and to theirs? What's your hourly rate?
It's whatever, like for my salary, it would be whatever gets charged for my salary that, you know, if I put that I worked on it a half an hour, that would be whatever my salary is. So it's basically what the cost, the actual cost is.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Hearing none, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Next on the agenda is Bureau of Personnel. Do we have our... This would be Mary? Mary Keeler, welcome, representing Bureau of Personnel to talk about South Dakota Risk Pool Fund Company 6521. Good morning. Welcome.
My name is Mary Keeler, and I'm with the Bureau of Personnel.
Push that button to make sure we're on...
There
you're on.
Go.
Thank you.
Again, my name is Mary Keeler, and I'm with the Bureau of Finance and Management, and I am here to answer questions that you may have concerning Risk Pool Fund 6521.
Okay. Why don't you, while we're looking this over, why don't you give us an overview of what this fund does, its sources of revenue, and where it's expanded, and just a brief overview, if you could, please.
I sure can. And what this risk pool is it provides coverage to those individuals who have lost their credible coverage through no fault of their own and make application to the risk pool within 63 days of losing coverage. Additionally, the pool was able to secure some federal funds, and there was an enactment of Senate Bill 200 in 2006 that allowed individuals to enter the pool based on having health insurance premiums at least 200% of the risk pool premiums. The target population of those individuals who are in closed blocks of business and whose premiums are spiraling upward. Then on July 1st of 2009, legislation allowed uninsurable children to join the risk pool. This was through Senate Bill 109. Currently, there is only one child that is enrolled in that. This fund is funded through premiums that are charged to the participants at a rate of 150% of a market level. We also receive funding from insurance companies through what's called a carrier assessment, and they currently pay 35 cents per person per month. And so that amounts to around, I think, about 290,000 covered lives per month. We also have a partnership with all of the healthcare providers where they are accepting a reduced level of funding when a RISPL member seeks care for their healthcare needs. The state also does contribute for 2011. It is $711,000 in general funds. And should there be any grants that are available, then the state applies for those with the federal government to help with any of the funding that might be out there.
Okay. I have a note here that at some point there were 632 members in the risk pool. Is that an accurate number today?
Yes, that is.
Okay. Questions from the committee, Senator Hunhoff?
Thank you. Do you have any breakout for this past fiscal year, how many dollars came in from premiums, and then what your carrier assessments brought in?
Sure. The premiums that were brought in for fiscal year 10 were $4,391,544, and the carrier assessments were $1,258,757. And that would be represented on your line 14 under sales and services is where the premiums and carrier assessments would be recognized.
Okay, follow up.
So then, where's the expenditures? Is that line 23?
All of line 24 are the total other fund expenditures for this program. So it would be your lines 18 through 23 would be all the specific expenditures for this program in that only were in the other fund.
The actual claims would be line 23, though. Is that right?
Yes, the insurance claims that were spent from the other fund is on line 23.
Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. Then would you please explain what you include in travel and contractual services?
Part of travel is actually there's generally about one event that happens. There is a national conference that a few members, employees do attend, and that would be their per diem, their meals, their lodging, and airfare for probably, you know, two people to attend this conference. Contractual would cover what we are paying for claims processing, disease management, any actuarial services that we may have. There's also going to be some internal service billing, such as your bit billings, your space billing, that would be allocated to this program. But the claims processing and actuarial and disease management also included in that would be risk pool commissions that are paid.
Go ahead, Senator Hunhoff.
Just a follow-up. On that travel for this national meeting, was that part of the arrangement in order for the federal dollars, or what kind of meeting are they going to?
They are going to, it's a national risk pool, state risk pool meeting, and it is, I think that just about every state has their own type of risk pool. not all of them meet the same criteria as what we follow, but they do have a national meeting for all of these risk pool managers to get together to learn about how other states handle their risk pools. And it does not have any ties to any federal funding.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Just one more, and that's under contractuals.
Yes.
There's sort of been a fluctuation over the years that are listed here. What was the increase for this year?
And actually, it is not an increase. You have to remember, when you are looking at this fund, you are only looking at a partial picture of the entire funding for the risk pool. The risk pool also has general funds, and there is also at times there's going to be federal funding in this program. But this is only a picture of the other funds for this program. So the actual contractual services for this program did not decrease. It was just the decrease in the other fund expenditures for those services. And each year the risk pool submits an annual report to the legislature. It is always due prior to January 1st, and that document would have an entire financial statement for this program and would give you the entire picture of all of the expenditures.
Last question. Go ahead.
Okay, then please explain to me on an annual basis in the years that are presented, how much federal dollars have we gleaned each year for this program then?
Each year? Sure. In fiscal year 10, we had $889,500. In fiscal year 9, $547,650. We did not have any federal dollars in fiscal year 08. And in fiscal year 07, it was $1,098,428.
Thank you. Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You partially answered my question. I think you talked about the state general fund of $711,000 does not show in the document we got in front of us.
That is correct.
But we have received updated yearly where it would be included.
That is correct.
If I'm right, Mr. Chairman. Do you have kind of the last 3 years what the state general fund has put in? Just curiosity more than anything.
I know last year it was $710,000, and I think the year before it was approximately the same amount. I did not double.
That's fine. It's been about that figure.
The last few years,
yeah.
Yes.
My memory goes back, and I can't remember a number. I was here when we started the risk pool. Was there not a substantial amount of state general fund money put in the first year?
And what you may be thinking about is when the risk pool reserve was established, and that was $1.5 million, and that had started as general funds and was deposited into 6521. And then the annual appropriation it started out at $500,000 and has grown slightly since the program began.
Okay. I guess history helps, but is it necessary? But if I might, just another question. As I looked at, you talked about one uninsurable child is in the program. Can you clarify why that child would not fall into the CHIP program?
No, and I think I will defer that to Larry Cucker, our program manager.
He's joining the meeting.
You know, maybe it isn't a pertinent question, but I would just almost think that a child would fall into the CHIP program. But if you would, Larry, thank you.
Good morning. Please identify yourself and go ahead and answer the question.
Good morning. I'm Larry Cucker, and I work with the risk pool programs for the Bureau of Personnel, State of South Dakota. In answer to your question, my recollection would be that it was income-related, an individual that falls between the gaps between CHIP eligibility and unsurability. But I think that individual came on the plan 2 years ago, if I recall. And that would be my response.
Well, you know, I was thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just trying to piece why it wouldn't, but I would suppose eligibility due to income would take him out of the chip, and yet they probably couldn't get insurance through the normal channels because of the condition of the child.
And the fact that there's only one uninsurable child on the state risk pool plan would indicate that most of them are moving over to CHIP.
So yes, maybe the question was pertinent. Thank you.
Of course. Senator Hunhoff.
Just one more. What determines the federal allocation to this program?
What determines that allocation is what the federal government has put out there for grants. It is not, we do not know every year if there's even going to be any type of grant available. Most of the grants, they find out probably in the fall of the year that something, fall or spring, that something might be available for the next year. The majority of them have been because of losses that the risk pool would have experienced based on looking at the strictly looking at the revenues from our premiums and carrier assessments against the claims expenditures.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Last chance. Representative Peters.
Thank you. And this probably also is a little off the topic, but similar with the federal government coming in, and we've got the $11 million coming in to do the risk pool for the federal side, how is that going to impact this fund? Or is this going to transition out? Will it be still around? What changes are we going to see in this particular fund for the future?
Did you want to? I'll let Larry go. Like he's working with
the pool. The federal high risk pool that we also administer is separate and distinct from this money completely, and the $11 million that you referred to, that's the allocation that the state has through the end of December 2013, plus the premiums that are collected will fund the program through that period of time or until such time that the funding runs out and the feds have to address it.
Mr. Chair, if I follow up.
Go ahead.
So what are the requirements? How are they different from the South Dakota risk pool to the federal risk pool? Can you explain or maybe chart out the differences of the two funds? Because there's going to be a lot of confusion in the next 1 or 2 years as far as not just the legislature, but individuals that call us and say, okay, I lost my insurance, what do I do? We need to be able to point them in the right direction. If you could explain the difference between the two funds.
Certainly. The South Dakota risk pool, as Mary described, is available for people who have lost their health insurance through no fault of their own. And no fault of their own would be defined, I just got tired of paying COBRA premiums. That would not qualify. But an individual whose insurance company may have left the state of South Dakota or may have expired their COBRA coverage through a former employer or whatever are eligible to come onto the South Dakota risk pool within 63 days of losing that coverage. The federal high-risk pool differentiates that a little bit in that an individual must have been without health coverage at all for at least the last 6 months and have a pre-existing medical condition. And there's about 20, 25 pre-existing medical conditions that are fairly serious, lifelong medical conditions. Those folks can make application. So when we administer both programs, that's one of the first questions that we ask is, have you had coverage within the last 6 months, which tells us to take the right fork or the left fork when they call.
Okay, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will you see a trend of people dropping the South Dakota risk pool because the premiums are too high, waiting the 6 months, and then joining into the federal program?
Good, and that's a good question because that was something that we were cognizant of. We haven't seen it so far. But on the other hand, We haven't seen a fluctuation in the South Dakota risk pool population, which would indicate people are preparing to stay without insurance or go bare for a six-month period of time. We're not seeing that.
Okay. Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. Just a follow-up, because I am unclear. You indicated that South Dakota risk pool will end on December 31st, 2013. Is that correct?
That's the plans with the Federal Health Reform Act, that all of these types of programs end on December, at the end of December 2013. That's the current schedule that we're hearing.
Just a follow-up. So then the next step on this, which was the question Representative Peters was asking, if this program goes away January 1, 2014, if health care reform goes as it's planned right now, those people will then get their insurance through the exchanges or they'll do something else, but this pool will not be in existence.
In theory, that's correct.
Okay, good. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Dennard.
Spurs the question. For the federal, they won't be without insurance for 6 months. They'll have the South Dakota risk pool under their belt. Or is that waived then?
I think the rules change on January 1st, 2014. I think everybody's in the pot at that time.
Well, I would sure hope so, because I'd hate to put them people out for 6 months.
It would be like the penalty box of health insurance. Other questions from the committee? If not, thank you. Mary, are you a veteran presenter to committees in the Capitol?
Actually, I'm not. What? I have attended for many, many years, but generally do not do the actual presentation.
Well, you're a veteran now. You did a nice job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up on the agenda is Department of Revenue to discuss the Bank Special Revenue Fund Company 6520. Gentlemen, good morning.
Department of Revenue.
Go ahead and identify yourselves and have at it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Roger Novotny, the Director of the Division of Banking, and with me today is Deputy Director Tim Ahartz, also with the Division of Banking. And I do have a handout, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, staff will get it from you and get it distributed.
I thought maybe we'd start out like the last speaker, maybe cover a little bit about what we do, when we do it, and how we collect our fees. And if at any time you want to interrupt for questions, we'll be glad to answer those at that point in time.
That works. Go ahead.
The Division of Banking is charged with regulating banks, 61 state chartered banks in South Dakota. And if you look at the charts that are being handed out on the back of the first page, it would indicate that our banks have been on somewhat of a roller coaster the last few years, although our number of banks have somewhat stabilized. Our number of assets have gone up and down in accordance with what happened in the banking industry. So our examiners predominantly work in the banking arena in partnership with the FDIC and Federal Reserve Bank as we do our exams. So we examine state chartered banks. Secondly, we also regulate trust companies in South Dakota. Trust companies would be the bottom chart on that second page. And there's a very rapid growth in trust companies. Now, we're at about 50 trust companies in South Dakota, and I think we have a half a dozen or so in the chute right now to be approved. So that's a very quick-changing industry in South Dakota. And as you can tell by the number of assets, we will be, I would predict, in January, over $80 billion in assets in trust in South Dakota, which is very substantial and a rapid change. And we do examine these folks on a regular basis, similar to the banks. We're trying to gain the expertise, obviously, as you can tell, that's changed very rapidly.
Okay, Senator Hunhoff.
Just a definition, trust company, what is that?
Those are companies that are almost organized like a bank, and they place in trust assets of individuals or private families to be put in South Dakota for use of our statutes, whether it be the law of perpetuity or no taxes in South Dakota. it's individual wealth that maybe even you and I might have in a traditional IRA, or all the way up to families that I've seen that have $40 billion in assets. And they're moving to South Dakota. You have a lot of expertise in the Sioux Falls area, so with our favorable trust laws, they are finding South Dakota to be an attractive place to end up.
Go ahead, yes, please.
Like, is this a business? I mean, is this like a trust officer at the bank? Or I'm sorry. Nobody advertises out their Hunoff Trust Company that I know of, so that's why I'm asking.
These are individual companies, like South Dakota Trust Company is the one that's in Sioux Falls, and they manage all these different types of trusts. It's almost like a bank trust office, but they're more national in scope.
Okay.
But it's something to watch as a legislature over the next few years. As this grows very rapidly, the division is going to need to up its resources to be able to handle these kind of assets, because that's really an incredible growth. We are the number one leading trust company location in the country right now, by far.
So before you proceed, take a moment and distinguish between how you regulate between banks and trusts, and what you said that's similar. Obviously, they're different in the way they're set up. You want to compare the two for just a moment?
I'll let Tim.
I'm more of the technical side of the division. So, on the bank side, we partner with the federal regulatory bodies. So we either partner with the Federal Reserve or the FDIC. Each bank is examined either on an annual or every 18-month basis, and we rotate with those two agencies. So we go in one year, they go in the next. Because of the size of some institutions or complexity, or if they find themselves in a less than satisfactory condition, we'll even go in jointly with the FDIC or the Federal Reserve. On the trust side, we don't have a federal regulator to partner with, and so we examine them wholly from our own resources. And we examine them as soon as they're chartered. We have to get in within the first 12 months to examine them for the first time. And then they go on either every annual basis, 24-month or 36-month based on code. And so we can extend, like if it's a private family trust that doesn't hold themselves out publicly to do trust management, we could maybe do that company every 36 months. Once every 3 years. If it's a South Dakota Trust Company who manages a whole bunch of trusts, we may go in there annually to make sure that they're adhering to trust laws and best practices. And so that's very simplistic, but that's kind of the differences between the two.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Proceed.
So we're through with the trusts and on to the licensees, and that would be the top bottom of the first page, number two, license fees. Those are additional entities that we regulate in the Division of Banking. Money lenders, a good example of money lenders would be payday shops, all the way up to GMAC or Honda Motor Credit. So those folks are all kind of thrown in that big lump of consumer lenders. Mortgage lenders, mortgage brokers, and mortgage originators, while that area has been shrinking in numbers, they still exist out there, and those are folks that, like Keystone Mortgage in Sioux Falls, Journey Mortgage is one of them. A bad example might be Countrywide on a national basis. We license and regulate all of those folks also. And money transmitters, the best example I can give would be Western Union. Usually people recognize what Western Union is like, and they do a lot of transmissions of money both in and outside South Dakota. I think the last numbers I've heard, we transmit out of South Dakota about $400 million a year, both nationally and internationally. So it's a larger business than what most might understand. So we get license fees from all of those areas also. We've covered most of the major areas. I thought I'd have Tim walk through the license fees and the fees that we charge banks and a little bit of a history behind that and some of the roller coaster that we've been on the last few years.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll point you to this chart here. I didn't put any numbers on it, but this shows our fund. I manage this fund on a monthly basis. I get all our revenues, expenditures, and I track the fund on a monthly basis, and this goes all the way back to July of 99. At that time, we had over $1.2 million in the fund. And we, if you look at the first graphic representation here, the chart under fees, back in 99, the fee was adjusted from, or 98, it was adjusted from 5 cents per 100,000 of bank assets to 3.5 in an effort to drive that fund down. They met in front of this committee. The fund was identified as having a little excess, so they drove the fund down. They did that over the next couple of years. In 99, it was reduced to 2.5. And then in 2003, they recognized, as you can see, we crossed the red line, which if you think of this as a checking account, this is our checking account. And so we average, back then, we probably average $100,000 a month in expenditures from personnel services and travel and things like that. So they recognized we had to build the fund back up. They had, they made the one adjustment to back to 3.5. And then up to 4.25, which drove the fund back up again to a level of, again above $1 million. So we gave a fee holiday in January of 2007, which meant we basically didn't charge the banks their fee for that time period, so we could drive the fund down again. We met in front of this committee again, and it was identified that we had too much, so we drove that fee down. What we have done since then is to try to get and try to grab a hold of this fund and try to even out the revenues a little bit, so we tiered them in 2007 and then further tiered them in 2009. Part of the reason is, and this is the difficulty, this is our largest revenue source is from the banks, and we charge an asset fee. Well, if you go to the back page of this, you can see we had a drop-off in asset size back in 2008. We lost Wells Fargo Financial Bank, who rolled their institution into the national charter. That was $6 billion in assets out of our, at current time, about $14 billion total. Or it was like $20 billion. We had reached $20 billion in bank assets, and then Wells Fargo Financial left the system. So we lost $6 billion in assets at one shot. And so we had some money management issues that we had to take care of. And in 99, we met with the Banking Commission and talked about tiering the system to kind of begin to even out the payers a little bit more so that we actually receive our costs from those that we regulate. A lot of times the bigger, larger institutions supplement the examination cost for the smaller $20 million banks. And so we tiered our fee so that we got more upfront for the smaller institutions so that we could, so we wouldn't have that large of an impact again with losing a large institution. And so that's why we've had these fee changes. What we have committed to, I think this committee at one other time, and also to the Banking Commission, is to further look at structuring our fees so that we can hold a balance without having these peaks and valleys. And one of the things that we've talked to with the commission is moving this from a semi-annual fee structure to a quarterly fee structure so that we don't have the large, we only get to, you know, January and June, or January and July, to move that to quarterly so we can stop the peaks and not get as much fluctuation on the top end and hold those down a little bit further through the quarterly assessments. And the Banking Commission was receptive to that. One of the reasons we haven't done that to this point is on the national level, the banks also pay the FDIC premium insurance for the FDIC fund, and there have been some significant changes in that structure, and we didn't want to add on to that and cause more consternation to our banks by making them adjust both funding mechanisms at the same time. There was a special assessment at the FDIC level, plus they moved the assessment from deposit-based to asset-based. And so we want that to kind of flow through the system before we start making gyrations of ours.
Okay.
I think that's most of the fees and where they come from. Maybe we'd entertain some questions, and it might prompt some more stuff from us.
Okay, any questions? Obviously, some members of this committee have probably been around for some of these previous presentations and the ups and downs of the system. Representative Dennard, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I've been around somewhat. I haven't been in this particular committee that long. As you said, you presented maybe a little bit off the subject back to the trust companies. Mr. Novotny, I was kind of curious, you talk about these fees or to rate for regulation, but the banks, we also in South Dakota have a bank franchise fee or tax, I guess you want to call it what you want. Are these trust companies subject to that also?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question, Representative Dennard. Over the years, trust companies have paid fees, just like banks, and they do pay the bank franchise tax, and so do banks, obviously. And I want to make that distinction. And these fees that we're talking about today have no relationship to the bank franchise tax.
Well, you know, and thank you. I understood that, but I was more curious about the bank franchise fee or tax, whatever you want to call it. It seemed to me we lost quite a few dollars in that particular income category in the last couple of years. My question then goes back to, if these trust companies are growing that much in South Dakota, we should be picking up some of that slack in that total franchise fee income.
Go ahead.
Chairman, we're not tax collectors, but I would anticipate we will see some increase from the trust companies as this grows over the next few years, as they tier in over a period. I think there's a five-year period for bank franchise tax where they go from minimal payments and that goes up to a minimum of $20,000 a year. But again, that's a good question probably for revenue.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? And I was unaware that trust company business was such a growth industry in South Dakota. I wasn't aware of the magnitude of that growth. It's been very substantial.
Mr. Chairman, if I could make a comment about the trust company growth, and I'm going to be leaving this job this summer, and one of my recommendations will be to both the Banking Commission and the Trust Task Force and the legislature that we need to develop some kind of a risk pool for this particular arena, not unlike maybe the FDIC insurance on the bank side. If one of these large trust companies should fail, it would be almost catastrophic to our little division. I've heard a talk in the industry that if a large public trust company failed, it could be anywhere from $2 to $4 million in receivership expenses. So internally, we've been looking at this for some time, trying to analyze this and figure out what type of options we would have available so that we would have a fund balance out there that we could use to at least get it into the receivership and into the court system. So it's a complicated process. We've dealt with Mr. Rounds over in the risk area. We've talked to some insurance companies and also the trust companies, and we're trying to develop a plan, hopefully within the next year. And by the next legislative session in 2011, you'll see some type of a proposal from us. In the meantime, with the banking fund itself, I think, is running about $400,000 a month, as Tim's comments talked about. I think we should look at right now probably driving that fund balance up as a stopgap in case something should occur. Now, we're risk assessors. We get paranoid. But if something should happen, it would be, again, disastrous. So I think over the next few months to a year, we need to be letting this fund probably raise itself up back to that $1 million level to make sure that we have a stopgap and so that we can catch a trust company should it fail because we just don't have the type of resources we would need.
So is it... Excuse me. So is it my understanding that you're suggesting that with the current rates and predicting economic conditions, you would expect to see this fund increase based on that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we would see the fund increase over the next 12 months.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Very nice presentation. We appreciate it. We have Department of Transportation scheduled for 11 o'clock. We're probably a little ahead of schedule. Let's, for a moment, before we consider taking a brief recess, Mr. Christensen, can you give us an update on single audit for a few minutes? Is that possible? A little birdie told me you came prepared to do that for us. Yeah, he is.
Okay, now I'm booming.
You are.
There you are.
Okay, I've handed out a recap on where we're at. We're in the heat of a lot of audits right now, and now some have been issued. Some of our where we issue separate reports and that, and I've identified those that have been issued so far, and the other ones, and where we're in progress on those. And I'll just briefly, I know we don't have, you know, we have a little bit of time in that, but I'll just briefly go over some of these, and if you have any questions on the audits, we can discuss those. It starts out with the audits that we've completed and issued so far. The South Dakota Economic Development Finance Authority, which is a business-type component unit that provides loans to companies to expand in the state. We did have a qualification in that opinion on those financial statements, as we have in the prior years, in that they do not provide a loan loss estimate. They do have the receivables on their financial statements, and generally accepted accounting principles would be that you would provide a loan loss, you know, for potential uncollected receivables and that, and they don't perform that estimate. And we think that would be should be performed as part of those financial statements. We did not have any written findings in this audit. Next audit, South Dakota Building Authority, component unit of the state of South Dakota. They issue bonds to finance public buildings. Unqualified opinion, meaning that it was a clean opinion. We didn't have any issues with any numbers in the financial statements. No written findings. The next audit was the South Dakota Investment Council. We performed this audit looking at various portfolios that they manage, including the cash flow portfolio, which is all of the state's idle cash. That's where the general fund cash would sit, the highway fund, all the other funds that you see in your other funds book. And then also the other portfolios, such as the Dakota Cement Trust, Cement Plant Retirement, Education Enhancement Trust, and Healthcare Trust portfolios. We had an unqualified opinion in all those portfolios, and there were no written audit findings. There's a couple audits that are in progress and are going to be released shortly here, probably this week yet. One is the Ready Fund, which is an enterprise fund of the state of South Dakota. We had an unqualified opinion. We did have written findings similar to what we had 2 years ago with this fund, and that during the audit we did identify certain errors in the amounts that were reported, and we're recommending that they improve their internal controls. And their response is that they are going to expand on a contract that they have with a CPA firm, and that to do some additional reviews to take care of those areas where controls broke down. The next audit that should be released here shortly, and that is the Education Enhancement Funding Corporation. This is a business-type component unit of the state of South Dakota that issued some bonds involving the tobacco monies from the Master Settlement Agreement, and that the opinion was unqualified and there were no written findings. Other financial statement audits that are in progress, the Cement Plant Retirement Fund, South Dakota Lottery Fund, two funds over at Department of Environment and Natural Resources, the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, and then, of course, we have the state's comprehensive annual financial report audit in progress also. One audit that will be started shortly here is the South Dakota Science and Technology Authority out in the Hills area. Audits of federal grants. We are primarily completed for this point in time since we're kind of in the heat of finishing up our financial statement audits now and starting the CAFR getting that up to full speed and that. Most of our federal grant audits have been substantially completed. There's one agency that we just couldn't start at the time. We're going to have to wait until after we get done with our CAFR, and that's Department of Health. But otherwise than that, the governor's office, Community Development Block Grant Fund, we have completed that audit. There were no audit findings. State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, that one is in progress. It's basically just starting. Department of Social Services, a lot of those are in progress and substantially completed. We looked at the Medicaid food stamps, the temporary assistance or TANF grant, Child Care and Development Funds, weatherization assistance, and what's called the aging cluster. Department of Health, we're going to be looking at the WIC program, Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program, and the immunization programs. Department of Labor, there's a separate CPA firm that performs unemployment insurance benefits part of the grant. The administrative part of the grant we have audited, along with the Employment Services Grant and Workforce Investment Act grant. At Department of Transportation, these are also substantially completed. The Highway Planning and Construction Grants, Airport Improvement, and Formula Grants for other than urbanized areas, which is like a transit grants. Department of Education, we looked at the Title I grants and special education grants. Those are substantially completed. I think they have been completed now. I believe that audit's into TIM. So, Department of Public Safety, that audit is completed. Public assistance. I think there's with most of these net that are in progress, net we're not seeing any substantial audit findings come out so far. There might be one or two come out by the time we get done reviewing in that, but there hasn't been any substantial audit findings that really to make you aware of at this point. Military and Veterans Affairs, we had two grants that we're auditing there, the military construction and the master cooperative agreement. And then the Department of Human Services, we did the vocational rehabilitation grant. There were no findings with that. That one is completed. Under Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, we looked at the capitalization grant, the Clean Water Revolving Funds, and the Drinking Water Revolving Funds, and also a Recovery Act program, that state clean diesel grant program. And it's very early, but at the universities, we'll be looking at research and development grants, which they receive a substantial amount, so we do a sampling of those and test those research and development grants. We did, South Dakota was one of the states that participated in the Office of Management and Budget Single Audit Internal Control Pilot 2 project. What that involved was some early reporting to OMB of internal control testing. They, for those that participated in that, we selected four federal programs. And I have them listed on there, the Child Care, Vocational Rehabilitation, Special Education, and Workforce Investment Programs. And then by the end of November, NAT perform testing of internal controls over six compliance areas, which I have listed there before you, and to report on them by the end of December of any deficiencies that we identified, and then the responses of the agencies for those deficiencies. Happy to report that there were no deficiencies identified, and we've already corresponded with OMB on that results of our internal control testing. In exchange for doing that early reporting, we were able to test two fewer grants, so that was a trade-off. So it saved us a little bit of time down the line here. Starting on page 4 and then going through the final of the report, these are audits that are performed by independent public accountants. The first one is the South Dakota Housing Development Authority. This is a component unit of the state of South Dakota. The firm was Ide Bailey. The opinions was unqualified. And as you can see, there were 3 written findings given on this engagement. Some involved the programs. Well, they all involved the programs that were looked at and errors that were identified in those programs. Agency obviously would have responded to them. Those will shortly be out on our website for you to look at the agency responses on those findings. The next audit is, as I mentioned, a firm does the unemployment insurance fund of the state and audits their benefits and that. So Cato Thorsenson performs that audit. They issue an unqualified opinion. There were some written findings involving audit adjustments, drafting of the financial statements, some of the postings to the general ledger, and some of the federal reporting and that wasn't being performed on a timely basis. Next audit then is the Corn Checkoff Fund of the South Dakota Corn Utilization Council. It's a special revenue fund of the state. It was performed by Ide Bailey. The opinion was unqualified. There were some 3 findings involving controls over financial reporting, some significant audit adjustments they identified, and then a lack of segregation of duties, which was also identified in the prior audit. Next one, Soybean Research and Promotion Council, another special revenue fund of the state of South Dakota, performed by Ide Bailey, unqualified opinion, and some similar findings involving internal controls over preparation of financial statements, auditors drafting the reports. There are some new ones involving the not having a formal policy required to review and approval of monthly reconciliations of the funds being held on deposit with the state, and then compliance with United Soybean Board regulations and contracts that should have existed but did not exist, in their opinion. They also identified the calculation of 2 assessments were in error and resulted in overstatements. The next audit, South Dakota Real Estate Commission, performed by East Vanderwoody, unqualified opinion, no written findings. South Dakota Board of Accountancy, an enterprise fund of the state, performed by East Vanderwoody, unqualified opinion, no written findings. South Dakota Health and Education Facility Authority, performed by Ide Bailey, unqualified opinion, no findings. And then lastly, the South Dakota Retirement System, performed by KPMG with unqualified opinion and no findings. Eventually, all these reports will be out on our website for you to look at the report and the numbers, footnotes, and any findings in their entirety. There are a couple audits that have yet to come through and be finaled yet. That's the Board of Educational Telecommunications, Public Broadcasting, Medical and Osteopathic Examiners, and then 2 agreed-upon procedures reports, which are less than an audit report. They go in and look at the internal controls of receipts and disbursements. 2 of those are outstanding yet, the Board of Technical Professions and the Electrical Commission. And with that, that's my report. Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Christensen? Sounds like you've been busy. It's good.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are going to take exactly a 5-minute recess and then proceed with Department of Transportation and any remaining items before us before we adjourn. So we'll be back in exactly 5 minutes. Okay, the committee will return to order. I believe we have Senator Bartling did join us by phone shortly after we got started, and I know Senator Gillespie tried to get on board, and I understand maybe there was a problem with the phone number at our end, and so I apologize to Senator Gillespie for whatever we might have done to postpone or not get her on telephone this morning. But next item on the agenda is Department of Transportation to review State Highway Fund, Company 3040, the Aeronautics Fund, 3041, the Railroad Administration Fund, 3042, and the Railroad Trust Fund, 3044. Secretary Berquist, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I have with me this morning Kelly Beck. Kelly is the Director of Finance and Management at the department, and she will correct for me all the misstatements I make throughout the morning. So,
perfect.
Do you want me to just walk through them in the order you presented, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
I'll begin with 3040, which is the State Highway Fund. As we know, this is the fund that we use for construction, maintenance, and supervision of the highways and bridges in the state, and also for our administrative costs that are associated with performing those duties. These funds, or at least a portion of these funds, are overseen by the South Dakota Transportation Commission. They're responsible for the allocation of all the highway construction funds out of this broader fund. In terms of revenues, the primary source of revenues into the State Highway Fund are from the motor fuel tax, which makes up about 60% of the revenues, and the motor vehicle excise tax, the 3% excise tax, which makes up about 30% of the revenues into the Highway Fund. The other roughly 10% is miscellaneous type of revenues, such as billboard fees, other permit fees, sales of property, excess right-of-way equipment, and those types of things. As I mentioned, the primary uses, it's the construction, maintaining, supervising, and administering the state's highway system and bridges. We do try to also not only take care of the state highway system, we provide some assistance to local government entities with their road systems as well. One thing, I do have a copy of the information that you were provided. There is a reference in the additional information on the back of the chart for the State Highway Fund, and it appears to be some notes from the last time I was in front of this committee in October of last year, and we talked about the economic development grant program within the department that comes out of these funds. It had been a $3.5 million a year program, or three components to that program. The size of the program was reduced back to $1 million. There was a period of time where due to the backlog of outstanding grants that no economic development new grants were being made. We did pretty much have now taken care of that backlog of outstanding grant projects, and the commission did award roughly $1 million again this year. I believe it was in August, wasn't it? September. At their September meeting, they did award about $1 million in economic development grant programs to some local government entities. So that's a one change from the notes that we had from last year when we met. Maybe just a few comments to make regarding the balance of the highway fund, and you can see that the balance has jumped substantially over the last fiscal year. A number of reasons for that. I think the biggest reason for that is the federal economic stimulus program. South Dakota received $183 million in stimulus highway funding out of that program. That program started in February of 2009. We essentially took our stimulus funds and split them into 2 years and tried to get half of it done, half of those projects done in 2009, and the other half were done this summer. How that impacted us was those stimulus funds, unlike normal federal highway dollars, did not require any state match. But there were specific and very tight time frames on use of those funds. So all of those economic stimulus-funded projects went to the front of the line, and it pushed off some of our normally funded highway construction that would have involved state funds. So we did that for 2 years in a row. In 2009, we jumped the stimulus funded projects ahead, pushed some of the state matched projects behind, and did the same thing in 10. So you, part of the reason for the growth in the fund is the deferral of some of those highway construction projects that did require a state match. That was one of the reasons. Now that program has just about run its course. Most of those projects are complete or very near complete. They're all committed to contract at this point. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 85% of our stimulus funds have been paid out. A few of those projects will carry over into next spring, and the balance of those funds will be paid out at that time. Another factor that we have dealt with actually for both of the last two construction seasons is we've had fairly wet weather. And that has resulted in, while we were rationing up the amount of construction projects we were letting to contract, our construction season was impacted both last year and this year due to the wet weather. So when we ended 9, we had a significant amount of carryover work that hadn't been completed as we had hoped during that construction season. So that was carried over into 10, and then we had another big 2010 planned as well. Again, especially in certain parts of the state, it was very wet. They got very late started a lot of the work. So we're going to have a lot of carryover work going into 2011. We have under contract right now, basically at the end of the construction season, we have outstanding almost $200 million in highway construction work and a lot of projects remaining to be let for next year yet. So next year is going to be another big year in terms of volume of projects and volume of highway construction dollars that'll be under contract. A third reason for that is we've been fortunate over the last couple of years that the revenues into the state highway fund have actually exceeded our projections. While they've remained relatively flat, we've anticipated larger reductions than we've actually seen, particularly in the fuel tax area. In fiscal year 2010, the most recently completed year, our revenues exceeded projections by almost $12 million. So those were additional funds that we were not anticipating receiving and have been included in that balance. And then the final point to make about the balance of the state highway fund. And as most of you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty out there about what the new federal highway funding program is going to look like. We still do not have a program. We don't really have anything significantly or seriously close to being passed at this point. We've been dealing with a number of extensions and continuing resolutions of the old program. I believe they passed one on Friday that carried us forward until December 18th. For some pro rata highway funding. The provisions of the old highway program called Safety Lou, those have been extended through the end of the calendar year. We anticipate both some additional short-term funding and extension of that program probably into the next Congress. We have a new chairman in the House T&I committee, which is responsible for putting together the draft of the program. He has indicated that he believes if he can't get a new program done by about August, it will sit on the shelf until after the next presidential election. So a lot of uncertainty there. You may have heard the president has proposed as part of his plan for future federal highway funding to what he calls front load the program with an additional $50 billion, which would the annual size of the old program is about low 40s right in there, so that would be a significant front loading. We don't know what match requirements are going to be, so we've been a little conservative with the cash balance in the highway fund, not knowing when that new federal program may get passed and what the match requirements are that could go with that. So. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think that's all I've got on the State Highway Fund. I'd be glad to answer questions on that before we...
Let's do that, Representative Dennard, to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burquist, you know, I was kind of curious, and you dove right into the stimulus dollars. But as I'm looking at this handout, page 179, I guess, so we're on the same page,
It's kind of interesting to me on your contractual services, 07, 8, 9, and 10. Is the two seasons in 9 and 10 account for the big, well, 50% cut or more in contractual services, and yet you spent most of the stimulus money, you said, but we went from $121 million down to $54 million of contractual services. Am I saying that right?
Mr. Chairman, if I might. Keep in mind, the spending of the stimulus money was federal funds, which is not reflected on here.
Oh, okay. So they're okay.
Yeah, but your point is very valid. It's the spending of those stimulus dollars that didn't require any match that resulted. It was a big part of why the amount of state-funded contractual services had dropped significantly.
So if I might, so if you would just, as a rough thing, move $40 million from your fund balance up to the 54 and have $100 million, I mean, that's technically, it's just unfinished projects or unlet or done projects.
It's kind of a combination of both. It's those unfinished projects that are out there that do require state match, and it's the additional projects that we were able to do that would have required state match before, didn't now because of the stimulus money, was 100% federal funding.
If I might, then just how did your contractors react? So you put off some state-funded, you know, matched projects. Did them same contractors then do some of the work with the stimulus dollars? I mean, so they reacted hopefully accordingly or in goodwill to work with this?
They did. This was actually a good thing for them because it helped them from the standpoint of it. Overall, it created some additional work and additional highway construction. I think, if I'm not mistaken, 2010, in terms of how much was contracted for highway construction, was the second biggest year ever. So it helped the contractors through a tough economic time because they did get additional work. The splitting of the stimulus funds between 2 years was our way to try to work with the contractors so we didn't dump a big glut of projects on them all at one time that they weren't prepared to handle, to try to spread it out over 2 years.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else regarding State Highway Fund? Okay, let's move to the next one.
The next fund is 3041, which is a state Aranax fund. The primary purpose of these funds is to facilitate air commerce in the state and to assist with airport expansion and improvements within the state. The source of revenues for this fund is the tax on aviation gas, which is 6 cents per gallon, and the tax on jet fuel, which is 4 cents a gallon. There are some other smaller sources of revenue, aircraft registration fees, interest. We do some inspections of airports for the feds, and we receive some revenue from doing that. The primary use of these funds, and these funds are overseen by the South Dakota Air and Ice Commission, is to provide the match to federal FAA dollars that are provided to South Dakota. Unlike highway funds, FAA dollars only require a 5% state match. Historically, the Transportation Commission has split that 5% match requirement and required the local entity that was receiving the benefit of the FAA dollars to pay 3% or 3 of the 5, and then the state would pay the other 2 out to total up the 5% required. In early 2010, the Air and Ice Commission changed that. They now require the local entities to put forth 2%, and the state pays out of the Air and Ice Fund 3% to come up with a total 5% match. One other comment about the funds in the Air and Ice Fund. There is a portion of the aviation gas tax and the jet fuel tax that is collected. It goes into the fund, and it's in the fund and held for the benefit of the local entity that actually collected the tax. Each airport gets a small percentage, gets to retain a small percentage of the jet and fuel tax that it collects, and then able to use that on projects on that airport. So there's about $1.6 million in the fund currently that makes up the balance, but it's really held for the benefit of the local government entities, and they've each got an account that we track how much they have collected, and it's held for their benefit. One of the other uses of the funds, in addition to providing the match for the federal FAA funds, on occasion, the Air and Ice Commission has chosen to do some projects on some airports and fund them entirely with state funds as opposed to matching federal funds. Just one example of that is we installed a number of automated weather stations at a variety of airports in the state. Those were paid for with state funds. The commission chose to pay for those with state funds out of the Air and Ice Fund.
Questions regarding the Aeronautics Fund? Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why would you not use, I'm over here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm hearing voices already.
And behind the curtain. Why would you not use those funds to match federal dollars? It was just that last comment you made. An example of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good question. I didn't explain that very well. Those are projects over and above our federal allocation. We get our federal funds, we use them all, and we have additional needs on some of our airports that are of a smaller dollar nature. So those are done over and above.
Other questions regarding the State Aeronautics Fund? Senator Hunoff.
Thank you. Just a question, as you were talking on that last sentence on that second sheet about a portion of the aviation collected by each airport, is there a maximum amount of percentage? Because if you look at that, I would look at Sioux Falls and Rapid City getting the bulk of the dollars.
I am not, Mr. Chairman, aware that there is a cap on that, to my knowledge. I know the split is 3.23 cents on the avgas and 1.175 cents on the jet fuel. I don't think there is a cap on it, but it is, as you point out, it is based on the fuel sold at the particular airport.
Other questions regarding this fund? Seeing none, we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next fund is 3042, which is the Railroad Administration Fund. This is a fund that was created to facilitate the administration and the management of the state-owned rail property across South Dakota. The main source of revenue into this fund is interest on the funds that are held in the account. We also receive a little bit of rental and fee income from use of the state-owned rail property, whether, for instance, leases of some excess or leases of some railroad property, haying and grazing permits, utility permits, those types of things also provide a little revenue into the fund. The primary uses of the fund is to pay those expenses that are associated with owning and administering state-owned railroad line. These may include such things as weed control, fencing, security, crossing improvements, warning signs, maintenance of records, staff time, those types of things. There is a balance in this fund of about $3 million. There are commitments for use of those funds over the next 2 years. About $1 million is anticipated in fiscal year 11 and $1 million again in fiscal year 12. A number of different projects in the works on the state-owned line, for example. There's some erosion repair that's needed on the line between Elk Point and Canton, some bridges that need repaired, some environmental cleanup that needs to be done at the Mitchell Roundhouse facilities. So those projects are anticipated to occur over the next 2 years out of that $3 million balance. Our projections are that the balance of these funds by the end of fiscal year 12 will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million. That's a little bit concerning from the standpoint when the primary or the main source of revenue into the fund is interest on the balance of the fund, and with the balance of the fund going down by about two-thirds, it's going to have a significant impact on the ongoing revenues into that fund. With that, Mr. Chairman, I don't think I have anything else. else on the railroad admin fund.
Good questions on that, Senator Hunoff.
Thank you. Has there been ever a cost-benefit analysis? I mean, I have sketchy remembrance of the history of the South Dakota-owned railroad, but has this board looked at continuation of state operating that or other options that are out there?
I don't know. I would, sorry, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that there has been a real comprehensive study of that, at least done recently. With the sale of, in 2006, of what we refer to as a core line sale to BNSF, that took a lot of those lines off the state system. So there are still a number of miles of state-owned rail line. They're much less than what they were. But I don't know that that type of analysis has been done, at least lately.
Go ahead.
Just for the question, for the sake of understanding, where would that start or what body would be involved in looking at that cost-benefit ratio?
I guess shooting from the hip, so to speak, I think that we would do that as an apartment. This is not really a fund that's overseen by a particular board. It's more of an administration fund within the department, so we would be pursuing that.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, on to Railroad Trust Fund.
3044 is the Railroad Trust Fund. This is the fund that is administered by the South Dakota Rail Board. The primary use and purpose of these funds is to make loans to regional rail authorities for railroad improvements on some of the state-owned line in South Dakota. It could also potentially be used for match for any federal funds. We haven't had that situation in a period of time. But and the primary source of revenue is the receipt of the interest back on the funds that are actually loaned out from the fund. This was also the fund that in 2006 received the initial proceeds from the sale of the core line to the BNSF, and then transfers are made out of the fund to the Railroad Authority Fund, which paid for the projects the state was committed to do under the agreement, and then $38 million was transferred into the Property Tax Reduction Fund at that time. So the remainder helped provide a balance in this fund that has been used by the Railroad Board quite aggressively, I would say, in order to make loans to either private railroads or most commonly regional rail authorities to make improvements to the state-owned line. At the end of fiscal year 2010, the fund had about $6 million in cash and a little over $25 million in outstanding loans. I mentioned that the rail board had been pretty aggressive with these funds since July 1. Virtually all of that remaining $6 million in cash has been committed to additional loans to regional rail authorities. The loans that come out of this fund are administered a little differently maybe than you would normally think of a loan. When a loan is made, the cash is not just provided to the regional rail authority, but a commitment is provided to fund the improvements that they want to make. So the regional rail authority will come in and get, for example, a loan from the rail board for $2 million. Once that is approved, they will go out and make the improvements. We will go out and inspect that they did the improvements that they committed to do, and then they'll be reimbursed for the cost of those. So while that remaining cash in the account has been loaned out, it'll remain there until the work actually gets done and reimbursements can be made. It's committed more than it's actually paid out. And I think I just really made that more confusing than it really needed to be. So maybe I better open that up to questions.
Any questions on the Railroad Trust Fund? I think I actually understood it. Maybe that's dangerous. Anything else for Department of Transportation, as long as we've got him in the hot seat here? Okay. Representative Peters says we can be easy on you today, but that apparently doesn't apply tomorrow, so stand by. But.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll hold you till tomorrow. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Okay, that concludes our review of various funds. We are thankfully a bit ahead of schedule. Let's talk about potential agenda items for future consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This summer, Senator Bartling, I don't know if she's still online, she and I had went over to Springfield to visit with the facility staff over there, and at that time, Corrections and DSS were also present in that discussion. And in light of a recent news story concerning some activity involving runaway youths in the Springfield community, and certainly highlighted one of the major newsprints, and was wondering if maybe we could request the Department of Corrections and DSS to provide us with a review or a summary of what they found as a follow-up to some of the concerns that were expressed by some of the community members there, and then report back to us.
That sounds reasonable. I read the same news report and recognized that you had been there earlier this year on behalf of our responsibilities as a committee to have oversight of juvenile facilities. This, of course, is a contract facility, but both the Department of Corrections and Social Services have youth that are at that facility, so I think that would be appropriate. Let's ask both those departments to either individually or jointly conduct some investigation and prepare some sort of review of that for this committee, and let's ask them to report back by February 1st, if that's appropriate. We'll be in session then, and perhaps the committee can call a special meeting to review those results. Does that work for you, Senator Hunhoff?
Yes, it does.
Any other comments or concerns about that? Representative Peters?
No, there's somebody online on the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead, Secretary Bartling.
Yes,
or Senator.
Senator Bartling, thank you. Thank you, Senator Hunhoff. I raised the same concerns that you do. We had a great visit at the Academy at Springfield, but since that publication of the article, it does raise concerns, and there have been changes in the administration of the Springfield Academy, so I know I won't be there, but I think it will serve the committee and the legislature well to look into that and, you know, have a comfort level as to how things are going. So just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other issues that we should have prepared for future meetings of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hunhoff.
Just a question. As far as I've been serving on this committee and just sort of wondering, with the issue of contracts, I know that through the course of being on appropriations and on this group, there has always been some discussion about some of the bidding that goes on for construction projects at higher ed and that process and engineers and utilization. And I'm just wondering if at some point in time we could look at that. I did have someone contact me and gave me some information regarding some of that bidding process. And just to review what does occur when those bids are, when building projects come through the appropriation process, certainly what we see is just what the project's going to cost and some of the, not any of the details. However, if you go on site and you visit some of those projects, they've had engineers or they've had consultants, not necessarily South Dakota based, out of state, that have come in afterward and, you know, provided some additional information. So I'm just raising the question, if we just look at what that bidding process is that's involved in capital projects, and majority of those are on university institutions, and just look at what that process involves. And, I know there's always the concern keeping things in state and, you know, just looking at why do you have someone come in after. And I think recent, wasn't there something in the paper also about a state project, and or maybe it was a city project that I was looking at. But anyway, just to look at that and refresh our memories on what that process is.
Okay. Tim is nodding his head. I think he has the gist of it. We'll allow staff to decide who and when should put that report together. Does that work?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to follow up on what Senator Hunoff was talking about, but take it just maybe one step farther as far as when we do, we sit on the Appropriations Committee and we see all of these repairs and maintenance and major, major renovations going on that happen throughout state government. Now, on appropriations and through the legislative process, we only see special appropriations bills for any new construction and any bids that go out for new construction. But there doesn't seem to be a limit of how much money any state agency can spend on repairs and maintenance or any major renovations. And I'd like to see maybe we can start the discussion on renovations, repairs and maintenance, funding of recent repairs and maintenance. And the one that comes to mind right now is the Redfield major renovations going on up at the Redfield facility that I, as an appropriator, was moderately aware of, and I'm sure the chair of appropriations might know more about it, but they're spending significant sums of money that are other funds that we were not given, we did not as a legislature give the express authority for. And so I just would like to maybe get a clarification of the process on where we draw the line as far as legislative authority and where we don't have legislative authority on extreme amounts of capital improvements in the state government.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dennard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to piggyback on that a little bit, Representative Peters, future senator, when we closed the minimum security in Redfield, I know they said they were going to utilize that facility and do some renovation, but as you said, we don't have any hands-on or input on it, but so that might be a key one to look at. If I might, on another subject, when Mr. Burquist is here, it's premature maybe at this time, and maybe through, you know, next year, Tim, how deep can we get into, and I'm going to just go to a specific project because it's close to me, the Highway 10 flooding and rebuilding this past summer, which is complete now. And I haven't followed up. I did some follow up through one of the highway commissioners, you know, on the bidding process and the way the bids came in and where the clay came from. You know, they talked 6-8 miles and then it was across the road. And I had neighbors contacted me and, you know, all this and this and this. And just recently, my son visited with one of the farmers that sold off the ground, you know, the bean crop that was on the ground, and then a good friend that owns the ground and the clay. I've got to do some more following up, but I'm premature, but can we request Mr. Burquist or the DOT to come in and give us an update on that project, Tim? I mean, and you know, I was told that this farmer hasn't been paid yet for his crop, you know. And I'm not going to say he hasn't today, but if I find that out, you know, I was just wondering, is that going beyond the scope of this committee to get real technical on that particular bid, that project? Tim, I mean, I don't know.
Mr. Flannery, would you like to respond?
Yeah. A couple of things. You certainly could ask Darren to come in and talk about that. I know in the past, you know, projects have come up and we've contacted DOT and specifically their project development officer, very helpful. And in fact, they could call you with specific questions and talk to you on the phone, whatever, or we could get information and I could communicate that to you, Representative Dennard, either way. But they're very helpful and they'll explain the current status of virtually any project, if you'd like.
Well, if I might, Mr.
Go ahead.
Chair, you know, I'm going to wait. That's why I think the comment or my question is somewhat premature if I'm going to request this, because I just the circumstances haven't been fully handled in my estimation yet. See, that's why, you know, I know these people well enough to talk to them. You know what I mean? That and if, you know, is the contractor reneging on some of his agreements with the people? And I just, you know, that's where I'm at the issue. So I'll follow up on it and be in touch with you and or the chairman.
I would say I think that's exactly the function of this committee. I think we have the responsibility to do that. I mean, a couple of years ago, we were dealing with the price of pens and pencils, which was very much a function. I think it had to do with the practices of how those contracts were let. And we individually as legislators get information from our local districts that doesn't seem to quite fit the mold. I think that's where our information comes from. Those are the kinds of things that we need to check up on. Obviously, we can do some preliminary checking before it comes to us in front of this committee, perhaps. But ultimately, that's the way this committee can get to the bottom of things, is to investigate those things. So I would think that certainly falls within the realm of what this committee can decide to do. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of going back to Representative Dennert's comment on the Department of Transportation, I'm wondering if we just have the DOT come in and do a high-level, quick overview starter on how they do the procedure. How do they pick a road project? When they pick a new interchange or a new, what is the policy and procedure that they go through? I know in my neck of the woods that I've got, I bet 30 different business owners all up in arms because the Department of Transportation, in conjunction with the City of Sioux Falls, are doing a project and they're not listening to the businesses in that area, telling them that this is not what we want. We want the road updated, but we don't want you to kill our business. And so I'm curious, maybe we need to have the DOT come in and explain how they decide what projects are done and when they're going to do a project, how they're going to do the project. Why are they going to go a certain route versus one thing versus another? Why are they? Why would they change it up? And maybe that's more than what Representative Dennert is looking for. But I'm always curious because now we've had the uproar in Sioux Falls on the 12th Street exchange with the new bridge over 12th Street on 29, and now I've got 90 and North Cliff, and they're still, those businesses now are going nuts. So I'm curious as to how the DOT puts these packages together. And they're multiple millions of dollar projects.
Well, if I might, you're looking at a big picture, and I understand this was a specific, and it was a flooded road that was closed for 6 months, and they came in. The original estimate was $1.8 million. The bids come in at $2.8 million, and they left the bid. They approved that bid. And now I'm hearing that they couldn't even get it completed for $2.8 million. I mean, for, a quarter of a mile, they had to raise it 5 feet. And I tell you, there was a lot of neighbors, a lot of discussion with DOT in this project. And now if I'm hearing things right, I don't like what I'm hearing. So I didn't want to know. I didn't want to overstep our realms as audit, but yet I thank you, Tim. I think we're in the right track. If it's something that needs to be followed up on a specific, I think this committee is the place to go with it. So, but maybe everything's up in the front. It was just interesting, though, when I visited with the highway commissioner, because when the paper said, the bid was so high because they had to go 8 miles to get the clay. Well, then when the dirt movers start moving it from across the road, they didn't have to go 80 rods. So was the bid conducive on hauling it 8 miles? And the answer I got was, well, they had to pay more for the clay, so the total cost was the same. They had to haul it 8 miles or 80 rods, and they had to pay more for it close. Now I'm here, and I don't even know if the clay's been paid for. So I got to follow up, Tim, and committee. It's just I didn't want to overstep the authority of this committee if I found something that I didn't think was right.
Let's conclude that this is well within the realm of this committee's ability to act in fairness to Department of Transportation. We've allowed them to leave the room before we've started to trash some of their practices. So I accept that explanation. Any other business to come before the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bartling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. Thank you to the committee. I've enjoyed working with you also for so many years, and this is my last committee meeting with you, and I wish you all the best. Just something as I'm going to be a taxpayer looking in now, and believe you me, I will be looking in. I would have a suggestion. Governor-elect Dugard has put another layer of executive branch in front of you. And my suggestion would be, do not fear to bring some of those folks on in to your Government Operations and Audit Committee as well as the Appropriation Committee. It's a level that the governor feels very comfortable with departments reporting to them and then thus coming on to his office. I think that level of government should also be responsive to the legislative branch. I have firmly believed in the powers of the legislative branch and that we should exercise it more appropriately and be more forceful with it. So I would be just very optimistic that you should, if you feel you should bring them in, bring them in. Don't feel that you need to back away from it, because the legislative branch of power is extremely a competent branch, and it should be a powerful branch. And so with my parting words, I wish you all the best, and exercise your powers as you see fit. I think you'll serve the people well. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your service, and we shall try to remain fearless, knowing that you're watching over our shoulders.
Yes, I am there, sir. Thank you.
Any other business? Well, before we adjourn, this will be my last meeting, my last tenure as chair. I've enjoyed this committee. Kind of felt like I got thrown from the frying pan into the fire when I was assigned here, but it's been an enjoyable committee, partly because it's been a good committee to work with, and in large part because of the legislative audit staff, Mr. Auditor General, and Tim Flannery has been a good right-hand man, and I appreciate that. So I've learned a lot in this committee. It's been beneficial to me. I'm sure that it'll continue to help me and as I continue in the legislature, but not on this committee. So I wish you all well. We'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Motion by Senator Haverly, second by Representative Turbeville. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. We're adjourned.